have a question. When you were talking about the nest, how the birds build the nest, and then you move to the elevator and to the software, you would take a use case, how they do it, and then you could improve on it, for example, right? And you could look at step one, step two, step three, and then shuffle them or move them. What about insights? Something that just pops up. You see something and it's something just comes to you. It's not, how do you explain that?
Insights.
Yeah.
Well, let's look at the child making the copy of the nest. The child is very likely to have lots of insights because the child is doing, as I say, a fundamentally hugely different thing in her brain than the bird is doing in its brain. But the bird is not entirely bereft of the possibility of insight. And it's very interesting to see the recent work in the last few years with birds, not nest building, but doing other remarkable things. How many of you know about Betty the Crow? None of you? Well, I'll show you, I think I can probably get the video up and running. Betty is a crow, a Caledonian, the New Caledonian crows from Australia. They're amazing. And Betty is put in a cage where there is a container, there's food at the bottom of this clear plastic container. And the food is even conveniently in a little basket with a handle. But Betty can't reach it with her beak. There is, however, a handy piece of wire. Betty takes the wire, bends it into a hook, puts the hook down the clear chamber, hooks it on the handle of the basket, and pulls the basket up to get the food out. Very impressive. That seems to show insight. I think actually a better example are Bernd Henrich's ravens. Very clever, much more natural experiment. He simply took little bits of meat, roadkill, but little pieces, tied them on strings, and then tied the strings to a clothesline. And the birds can see the food hanging on the strings, and they can't get the food off the strings by just flying by and trying to grab it. They try that a little bit, doesn't work. So then they perch on top of the clothesline. They reach down with their beak and they pull up a bit of string and they put it under one of their feet to hold it. And they keep doing this till they pull the string all the way up and then they get the food. Very impressive. And no training. They do that on their own. We don't know if it's just time, not enough time and not enough human ingenuity has gone into exploring the insight of birds further, but these and half a dozen other similar experiments have raised the appreciation of the degree of behavioral comprehension, sort of. They also, however, fail some tests that you would expect birds that could do this could also do that, and very often the answer is no, they can't. So it's a very alien sort of apprehension, and there's things that, you know, a two-year-old child or a three-year-old child would get immediately, but they don't get. So they're not that. Indeed, they are, you know, there's myths. Apes were purported to solve the problem of piling up the crates, putting the sticks together to get the bananas, and you can see the video of it. And it was such a famous experiment way back in the, 20s, that Bertrand Russell had a funny joke about it. This was the era of behaviorism when Thorndike and others were running rats in mazes, and Russell observed that it was interesting how experimental animals seemed to mimic the psychological qualities of the nationality of the researchers. American animals bustled around very energetically, try and fail, trial and error, till they got it. German animals just thought and then solved it. That was the story, but it was false. In fact, Kohler's apes had a lot of training. They didn't do it first time. There was a lot of trial and error that didn't get into the film. So they weren't as contemplative, they weren't as Kantian, as Goethe-esque, as some people thought. Sorry, too long answer. Another question?
This is about the notion of the umwelt or environment. So there is, a striking difference between the umwelt of the elevator and the umwelt of a bird, right? So the umwelt of the elevator appears to be perfectly well defined by the designers, and whatever lies out of this umwelt, well-defined umwelt, is something that the elevator will not react in any way. But this is not so for an animal like a bird. So when something unexpected happens, but somehow matters to the bird because it concerns the basic needs and goals of the animal, typically reacts in an appropriate way, in a very fast way, in a very effective way. My question is, do you think that this somehow requires some kind of internal representation of goals or some kind of rules on the mind of the bird, as by comparison with the what happens with the elevator? Thank you.
You point to a very important difference, but I think it's a difference of degree, not of kind. There is a sort of representation of the position of the elevator in its shaft and the location of passengers, but as you say, it's a closed umwelt. If something happens that hasn't been designed for, it's completely clueless. It's completely graceless. It has no way of responding at all. It may probably just stops, or heaven forbid, plummets to the basement. It is not equipped to ad lib in any way. Whereas a living organism, although it may occasionally just sort of go into shock to sort of stop, you know, and get eaten, will more likely engage in some behavior which looks novel. But whether it's just a desperate thrash or whether it has some insight behind it is always an open question. The fact that a bird has much more elaborate sense organs than an elevator means that it has to be prepared to deal with a lot more varieties. Still, most of it is just meaningless to it, but it still has to deal with a lot more variation. The input signal class is hugely greater than it is in the case of the elevator. But you could change that. You could put a television camera, digital video camera, in an elevator, and a microphone, and you could give an elevator speech recognition and the ability to tell a sofa from a passenger. You could do all of that if you wanted to. And then the difference would be diminished between the bird and the elevator. And if you think there's still always going to be a fundamental difference, we'll have to talk about that and see what it is. Maybe there is, but I would think if it mattered to us, we could bridge that difference and give the elevator a still more bird-like or dog-like or dolphin-like umwelt. It's just that it doesn't pay to do that now.
Well, you talk about the free floating rationale, and I would like to know what's the relation between this and the brains, and if this is
brains.
And if we can understand this as a vector that explain evolutionary the emergency of brains to manage these free floating vectors. And then if we have to conclude that in the natural selection explain the rationality, if there is a relation between both.
Well, the free-floating rationales are the rationales of the, in effect, the design decisions that natural selection hits upon. There's reasons why this is the way these organisms are designed. But it goes all the way, there's a free-floating rationale for the design of a bacterium or a tree. So it doesn't have anything direct, always to do with brains, since neither trees nor bacteria have brains. But indeed, the big difference between, say, a plant and an animal is that the animal needs a fast control system which has more degrees of freedom and is better at predicting the future than a plant does. The locomotion and perception go together. So that's why when we look at animals, from insects on up to us, we're tempted to attribute all the cleverness we see, all the adroitness of response, all the appropriateness of counter move that we discover in animals to things understood by the animal in their little brain. But that's, I'm submitting, largely a mistake. What we've done is uncovered the free-floating rationale of their behavior, it's evolution's rationale, which was never understood by anything, never articulated by anything, until we theorists came along and figured it out. Because this is unintelligent design. But it's the results of unintelligent design can be so clever that we misattribute the cleverness to the beneficiaries. So in a way, just to pursue, I think, your question, that gets us animal brains, but how do we get to Gaudi's brain? How do we get to Turing's brain, where there is real comprehension going on and where the rationales we come up with aren't free-floating? They're anchored, they're represented. Well, I've just given you one example of intelligent design in action, the software team starting with a problem and solving it from the top down for the elevator. In general, I think that's how intelligent design works. It's top down as opposed to the bottom up methods of evolution.
I'd like you to elaborate a little more on the distinction between behavioral competence and behavioral comprehension, in the sense that the competence is something that is there,
yeah,
and the comprehension is something that we put on top of it based on our knowledge, mainly the tiny knowledge we have on neurosciences, the tiny knowledge we have in psychology, and always keeping in mind that likely less than one per 10,000 of our brain is consciousness. The rest is working there, but that it's extremely hard to know what our brain is doing to try to, I mean, it's nearly impossible to try to make a rational thinking on the way that we may understand what we are doing. So the competence is there. The comprehension maybe is really far, far, far away.
No. I would want to change one phrase in what you said, and that is, I don't think, maybe I misheard you, I don't think we use or need to use any appreciation of neuroscience yet to inspire and guide our attribution of behavioral comprehension to the animal. Here's what I think is actually going on. Oh, we know they have brains.
That would be fantastic to have. We know the possibility of integrating neuroscience on that.
We know they have brains. We don't know that much about how they work. We know some things. We know they have eyes and ears, and we know we're getting more evidence every day. But to assay the appropriateness of their behavior, we don't need to use that. We put the relevant information in front of their senses, and to our delight, let's say, they respond appropriately. So we see, oh, they understood that. Look how well they behaved. Now, we say understood. What they've exhibited is competence, and it may be higher and higher and higher competence. What I'm leading up to is the claim, which I think is implicit in Turing, that what comprehension is this competence built on competence built on competence, and the myth that comprehension is this extra thing on high, that is itself part of the sort of Cartesian myth. It's just not true. But it seems true. And it seems true because, as you say, we understand what the birds do. We really understand what the birds do. So we have a first-person perspective on our own understanding of what's happening and on what others are doing. And so we, first of all, we generously are inclined to attribute the same understanding to the animal. Seldom good evidence for that. That's what the higher order intentionality research is all about. Does other animals have a theory of mind? Do they treat other animals as having minds? There's problematic evidence about that at best. But we to sort of echo Hume, we project our understanding onto the animals. Yes. Now, as we learn more and more about brains, we're going to be able to do something different and better, but we're going to drop down into the scientific image to do that. And what I'm predicting is that when we do that, we will find that we're in sort of terra incognita. If we go looking for beliefs and desires and hopes and fears and so forth, we're not going to find them. Because the categories of our own first-person point of view, the affordances of human reflection are so different from the affordances of animal control that we won't find them. So that we make a big mistake if we imagine that our dogs, they think pretty much the way we do. We're not going to find that's true. And that's going to unsettle a lot of people, but that's what we're going to find.
I have a second question. You have not, when you have been talking on what you said, sort of, whatever, to which extent this could be combined with irrationality, or to which extent what in computer science called heuristics is similar to that?
Oh, good, yeah. I'm actually going to be talking about this not in the next lecture today, but tomorrow. You can't be here, I guess. But I'm going to be talking about good old-fashioned AI, GoFi. And good old-fashioned AI, actually, I will get to it. I will get to it in the second hour if we stop and have coffee now. So why don't I leave it at that?
You want to leave the present? Okay. So coffee break.
Yeah. Hello? Is that on now? Yeah. I can't seem to find the right pace. I either go over or go under. But so I'll go a little bit fast now. But I want to give you something that I'll hook up with later. This, of course, is the Reverend Bayes and of Bayes' theorem. And the current bandwagon in cognitive science is predictive coding, predictive error minimization coding inspired by Bayes' theorem. And it seems to be a very fruitful way of thinking about minds. So I'm going to just sketch very quickly how we could apply this new perspective to understanding how manifest images get built. I've already stressed that affordances are opportunities for action, and every affordance yields a predictive action tendency. It sets up a sort of forward model, which we can then read backwards, more or less. And I think this is the right way to understand the predictive coding models. I'll say more on that in the last day, in fact, in the last lecture. So there's our canonical comparison between the termites and the termite colony in Gaudi's Sagrada Familia. And as I say, one is bottom up, the other is top down one's intelligent design and one is evolutionary type design. I want to look at another example now, which is, I think, really interesting, and I'm surprised more people haven't thought about it, and that's K-25 at Oak Ridge in Tennessee. When it was built, it was the largest building in the world. It was built in secret during World War II, and this is where plutonium was turned into weapons-grade fuel. And thousands of people worked there, round-the-clock shifts, and this is the amazing thing. They didn't have the faintest idea what they were doing. Hmm? Well, the thousands, obviously somebody did. But this is what's so amazing, that they hired thousands of people who, the morning after Hiroshima, they learned what they'd been doing, and they were amazed. They'd had all, and first of all, they weren't supposed to talk amongst each other. They weren't supposed to speculate. It was one of the most extraordinarily well-kept secrets ever. And so I get interested in, all right, how did they do it? How'd they do it? It's a demonstration that it is possible to organize armies of clueless operators to perform some highly sophisticated control task. It's possible. But who or what does the organizing? Oak Ridge was intelligently designed. classic case, top down. They knew exactly what they wanted to do. They knew the steps that they had to figure out. They knew the resources they would need. And then they brought in thousands of homunculi to do the work. So it was top down, in the way Gaudí's church was, but even more so. And as we learned, Gaudí, although he was dictatorial and autocratic, he also listened to people, and there was some collaboration there. And of course, there was a sort of a hierarchy of understanding among the people working with Gaudí. Much less so in Oak Ridge. There was a very small group that knew what they were doing. The people who built the building didn't know what it was for. The people who put a lot of the machinery in the building did, and the architects, the engineers who designed the equipment, they had to know a lot about the specs for the building. But as few people as possible knew what was going on. Now, of course, Turing's computer is another great example. Interesting, from World War II, two great examples of intelligent design, where you have the concept worked out very clearly in advance, proof of concept, articulated, defended, the reasons were expressed and proven before a dollar was spent to build a computer. Same thing was pretty much true with Oak Ridge, although actually one of the interesting things about Oak Ridge is that when they started building the building, they didn't know whether it would work at all. It was one of the greatest gambles in the history of government. And if it had failed, Roosevelt would have been impeached, and it would have been the greatest scandal you can imagine. Well, this is like good old-fashioned AI. The term is GoFi is sort of entered the language of the history of artificial intelligence, created by John Hoagland, the late John Hoagland, dear friend of mine. Good old-fashioned AI. It was the AI of McCarthy and Newell and Simon and Minsky. It was the original AI, which was very top-down, and a sort of trivial example is the elevator operator. They were after much bigger things. They wanted to do human intelligence, true AI, but starting at the top, decomposing it into what parts had to be there and what they had to do, and then a cascade of specs down through till you finally got down to the adders and subtractors that could be replaced by a machine. Here's my cartoon sketch of good old-fashioned AI, the walking encyclopedia. The idea is that this is what an intelligent being is. It's got this huge store of knowledge, all written in propositions in some language, which could then be used to prove theorems. So you had your theorems, you had your axioms, and then you had your theorems, and you had a resolution theorem prover, which would generate all the implications that you needed, and in jig time, so that you could act on it. And so you had your perceiver, which led to belief fixation, which filled up the world knowledge, which then was the database that you generated the axioms for to do the action planning and to deliver the action. And there you can see the language acquisition device and the lexicon if it's a speaker, and you've got your logic unit, which does the work. So this is just a parody of the sort of boxology, as we called it, that people engaged in, where you broke down all the parts, the cognitive parts. So this was a highly intellectualized vision of what an agent would be. And as you see, I've drawn a line through it. It's not the way it works, folks. And good old-fashioned AI is not, strictly speaking, dead. It lives on in some amazing projects, such as the PSYC project, CYC, of Douglas Lennox, which is the ultimate GoFi project in that it's all hand-coded by hundreds of people who are writing down the world knowledge, It's called Psych, which is short for encyclopedia. Basically, they want all the facts from aardvarks eat ants to zebras eat grass in this giant database, and then with theorem proving on top of it. It's been going for several decades. Doug Lennett calculates the amount of work that's gone into it in person centuries. And it's far from complete. And a lot of people think that it'll never work. But it's been done in the open and without secrecy, so nobody will ever be impeached if finally they give up on it. Back to Oak Ridge. Who knew what at Oak Ridge? As near as I can tell, there's still no publicly available information about this. At the head of it was a man named Leslie Groves, General Leslie Groves, and he was clearly a very intelligent designer and a heck of a politician, too. So did most of his immediate staff and many who reported to them, and the head engineers who designed the plants. And is there a sort of diminishing level of competence all the way down? Apparently not. It stops very high, and everybody below that is just clueless. This was wartime secrecy. Imagine visiting Oak Ridge and working our way up. You ask them, what are you doing here? I don't know, I just work here. You ask that guy's boss, he says the same thing. And up, and up, and up. At some point, the answer is it must be a lie. At some time, you've got to have people that know what the heck they're doing. But this was a very unusual organization. Unlike, say, General Motors, where you have a distributed hierarchy of competence and comprehension that goes up and down. This is as much as possible. Oak Ridge was as much as possible competence without comprehension. Only at the very highest levels did you have comprehension. In human organizations, there can be a scale of understanding as we ascend and descend the hierarchical ladder. You know, X doesn't know how to arc weld, but knows what the arc welder is supposed to produce. Y doesn't know what X organizes the arc welders and other fabricators, but knows what the group is supposed to produce, and so forth. The CEO of Ford Motors couldn't build a car to save his life. Doesn't have to know how to do that, because there's the hierarchy underneath that. And so, in most human organizations, you get the I can't see the woods for the trees phenomenon. Levels of granularity and insularity throughout the organization. And the bird's eye view versus the termite's view makes good sense. The CEO has a bird's eye view, in effect, and the worker on the shop floor has the termite's view, more or less, but in fact knows more than the termite does. So human organizations are much more distributed comprehension than in, say, a termite colony. In a termite colony, no termite or junta of top termites sees the woods at all. That's what's stunning about a termite colony. This has one very important effect, and that is that redesign is achingly slow. It takes evolutionary time to redesign a termite colony. If you rig a novel circumstance for a termite colony, it's doomed because it doesn't have critics that can comprehend what's going wrong, because it doesn't appreciate the design of itself. Now, if you read Paul Seabright's wonderful book, The Company of Strangers, you realize that that's also, to a rather worrying degree, true of national economies, true of economics. I wrote the foreword for the second edition of that book, and my example there was, you know, you don't have to know how your car works. If it breaks down, you get towed in, you buy a new car, or somebody there knows how to fix it, you don't have to know how to fix it. Well, you might think the same thing is true of an economy. If it breaks, well, we'll get the economy mechanics to fix it. No. There's nobody that knows how to fix it. And that's, in fact, according to Seabright, a built-in part of the system, is that the specialization, the compartmentalization of know-how, the economy wouldn't work without that compartmentalization. The price we pay is that if it really breaks, there's nobody around who knows how to fix it. Interesting idea. Another effect with no boss is that there's no issue of what the boss has access to. So there's no reason to posit access consciousness to the colony. So it's not like anything to be a termite colony, which I think fits our intuitions. It may be like something to be a termite, but it isn't like anything to be a termite colony, and it isn't like anything to be the Seattle Seahawks, you know, or the Boston Celtics. It might be like something to be Barca. Really, I mean, if you're going to choose a team where it has a sort of organization where you think that there might be a sort of group mind, that's probably your best example. So compare the organization at Oak Ridge to the organization of the mind, brain, and GoFi. See the LAD, the language acquisition device up there, just one of the modules. Does the LAD know its job is acquiring a natural language? No. Does the belief box understand its role in informing the other departments? No. No, only the AI designers know these things. GoFi, then, in other words, is top-down intelligent design, where the understanding is only in the people that design the modules. The modules themselves just do whatever they do. They're more like groups of workers at Oak Ridge. Now, this is not the familiar criticism that everything these AI systems know is what their creators installed in them. No, in fact, many of the best GoFi systems go way beyond their creators and what they know, what they can do. So chess programs can typically beat their creators at chess. This is the point that the design of the architecture that supports this knowledge is top-down designed. That's not nature's way. And when we turn to the design of the human mind, we've got to abandon top-down design and rethink the design of the human mind in a bottom-up way. Not hierarchical and efficient, but semi-chaotic, semi-democratic, with a lot of competition. And that's for another lecture coming up. We have to rethink the architecture of the brain. Yes, the brain is a computer, but it isn't like a GoFi computer. It's a very different sort of thing. Now, the need to know principle I've often talked about, and in security, as in Oak Ridge, the workers at K25 are not like termites, a very important thing. They were curious, knowledgeable people who would like to read newspapers and know what they're doing. And this was a constant problem. Here's a sign, a photograph. What you see here, what you do here, what you hear here, when you leave here, let it stay here. This is not what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. This is much more strict. And recently read a good book. There's a wonderful book about the women. Most of the people there were women. And the women at Oak Ridge were a really interesting fraternity of unsung heroes. And they had no clue what they were doing there. They flocked from all over the country and bravely got onto trains that they did not know the destination of those trains. And you think about it, these were some intrepid young women back in those days, and they took on these jobs, and they got trained up in jig time, and they became expert operators of these machines where they were turning the dials and pushing the buttons, and they did not know. They had a user interface, they had a user illusion, but they didn't know what it was doing. Their incomprehension had to be enforced, but their bosses and their bosses' bosses had to have somewhat more global understanding. The brain is different. There's no General Leslie Groves in your brain. But there seems to be. I, me, myself, the self, the ego, the one who has access to much, not all, of what is going on, the work the brain is doing. But this self is not an organ of the brain. It's not the central headquarters, the Cartesian theater, where the res cogitans presides and understands what's going on. We have to can get by with just competence. Design black boxes that will keep the organism out of trouble, provide the organism with the right input-output profile. It doesn't have to understand. The butterfly has those beautiful eye spots on its wings, and it opens its wings, and those eye spots scare away the bird. The butterfly doesn't need to understand that. It's a beneficiary of a design that it doesn't need to understand. Everywhere we see that in nature. And that natural selection can be stingy, but it also can be a spendthrift. It can pour incredible, wasteful resources into a problem and get a result. It has no budget, except a time budget and a design budget. R&D is expensive. It takes time and energy to improve designs. What does a starfish need to know? Next to nothing. Competence with hardly any comprehension. How about an octopus? Much more behavioral comprehension. How about a wolf? Here's a shocking possibility. A wolf is more like a termite colony than you might have thought. Termite colonies are very clever. They forage, they defend, they build air conditioning into their houses. They have an economy that is fantastic. Millions of cooperating individuals that forms a unit that is so clever as a unit that there was a book written called The Soul of the white ant being a term for termite, which attributed a soul to the colony. But of course, that's a mistake. Bill Calvin writes of things we know, but of which we cannot speak. And there are many, but just for us too. Competences of which we're the beneficiaries without being able to explain. Varieties of know-how. How to walk, how to talk, how to look, how to vomit when necessary. Now the question is, does a wolf know how to hunt? Well, yes, but it doesn't know how to speak of it. Cannot speak of it. But it knows how to hunt. This is a behavioral competence and a sort of behavioral comprehension, but it isn't like human comprehension. We indulge our imaginations when we spot what we see as cleverness. In many instances, it's not the cleverness of the animal, but of evolution, the free-floating rationales. Okay, that's the end of this morning's first lecture.